but I felt some of you might be interested. It's about proving Liouville theorems for quasi-conformal maps. So beginning conjecture and also in higher D with less and less regularity. And so I suggested that they should, we should embrace them and have them come in here.
What it is broken.
So tomorrow you're going 10:30 to 12, right?
Yeah, I think. Right.
So if you're interested, it's going to cost you most of your lunch break. So four interesting things.
So where is this? Okay.
Hopefully here.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to introduce Costello for his part three.
Okay. Thanks very much. I guess so Gabriel is going to give the next part three. It's probably more appropriate for you because you're from Cambridge.
Why? Why?
So you don't have part three as part, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So what we left off with yesterday is so let me just recall what we've been doing. So the question we are interested in is the inner form for the Schrödinger equation on a Riemannian manifold. So Mg compact with boundary. So if you have two potentials for the Schrödinger equation in M, and they are such that the Dirichlet-Neumann maps for V1 and V2 are the same. The question is to show that the V1 is equal to V2. And so we've reduced this to a different question to the density of products of solutions. So the products U1, U2, these are any H1 solutions of the corresponding Schrödinger equations in M is dense. So this set is dense in L1 of M. Okay. So yesterday I basically outlined to you what is the usual proof of this density statement in Euclidean space Rn n bigger than or equal to 3. And I somehow then gave you some arguments on how one could try to extend those ideas into the Riemannian case. And really the fundamental concept here is that of a limiting Karlmann weight. So eventually we would like to use solutions U1 to the minus phi over H M1 plus R1 U2 equals E to the phi over H M2 plus R2, where these M1 and M2 are some kind of complex amplitudes, and this is the stuff which I haven't really said anything about, and I won't do it today, but I'll do it tomorrow. And then somehow this R1 and R2 you think of as correction terms which should go away when you take the asymptotic limit when this parameter H goes to 0. So basically you want that R, this. So all of yesterday was devoted to somehow understanding So when can you expect to have something like this? So some conditions on the this real valid phase function phi, which would ensure that you can always, given amplitude m of some type, you can find a correction term r which is small in the asymptotic limit. So we basically, if we can guess what m is, so then r will be the solution of the equation, so correction term. R obtained from okay, so in this case it would be an inhomogeneous equation P phi of R1 equals F1 P minus phi of R2 equals F2, or F1 and F2 are some functions depending on this M1 and M2. So this function equations in M where these Fj's are in L2 of M. Okay, so basically limiting Carnot weights are related to the solvability of inhomogeneous equations of this type with the right kind of norm estimates. So we saw that So yesterday we didn't actually show that you can solve this equation. We just derived some condition of phi under which you might expect that you might be able to solve these equations. And today I'm actually going to show you that this condition is sufficient. So phi should satisfy this limiting Karman weight condition. So let me recall what it looks like. So it's a condition on the Poisson bracket of the principal symbols of the self-adjoint and skew-adjoint part of this operator. So I'll write it again. So the Poisson bracket of small a and small b should be zero at all points in the cotangent space where both a and b vanish. And I'll just write down what A and B are. So they are these functions on the cotangent space. And also, assuming this condition d phi is not equal to zero. Okay, so this somehow was the symbol of the commutator of capital A and capital B, and we saw yesterday that if the commutator is positive, so then we have a lower bound for the operator P phi. And so really we need this condition to be invariant under the change of sign in phi, so we actually get the limiting condition when there's no positivity here. Okay, so in the case when we got this condition and then we analyzed for what kind of manifolds do you expect this to hold, and we actually were able to characterize all of the manifolds for which such a function phi exists. Okay, so now let's say if you would have strict positivity for the principal symbol of the commutator, so then this basic facts in semi-classical pseudo-differential calculus is basically Gordings inequality. Would imply a Karman estimate of the following type. Okay, so I guess so let me still recall what this P phi is. So P phi is the semi-classical Laplace-Beltrami operator on M conjugated by two exponential weights. So there's an h squared here. And somehow if you think of the fact that you have an h squared here and then you have an h here, and when you cancel then you have an h here. So this is actually going to tell you that the L2 norms of the RJs are going to be bounded by constant times h when h goes to zero. So they do indeed go to zero. Okay, so as I said, if you would have trig positivity, then Gordian's inequality would give you this estimate, actually with a better pulse of h here. So that's somehow standard thing in Karlmann estimates. But if we have this, so then when you change phi to minus phi, then this thing will be negative, and as I argued by using this argument, which David de Santos has outlined, then the Karlmann estimate would fail for minus phi. So we really do need this limiting condition. And so if we only have this, so then the Gordian inequality is not going to give us anything. So this condition immediately is not going to give us a Karlmann estimate. And I think it's kind of remarkable that even in this somehow degenerate condition, you still have a Karlmann estimate. It will come with weaker power than the one which you get when you have strict positivity, but still you would have it. Okay, so how would one prove the Karlmann estimate starting from this condition if you only have this weak or degenerate condition? Okay, so one way to do this is to do a little trick, which is often called convexification. So instead of using this function phi, which we have, which is a limiting Karlmann, we replace it by a slightly different function, which gives you a little bit of positivity in the commutator. But the point is that we cannot change our phi too much, because if we change it too much, then we get a nice estimate, but it's not going to give us an estimate for the original weight, because eventually we do need to solve equations like this, both for the original phi and then the original minus phi. So this amounts to replacing phi by something like this. Okay, so there's many ways of doing it, but I'll use the following idea. So you add something to your phi, and the idea is that somehow this positivity for the principal symbol of the commutator is related to some kind of convexity, or the precise word is pseudo-convexity of the weight function phi. So the idea is somehow you add a little bit of convexity to your function. So for instance, if phi of x is x1, then this one would be x1 plus constant times x1 squared over 2, and that's a convex function in x1. Okay, so what is epsilon here? So epsilon is some parameter independent of h. Okay. The idea is somehow that when eventually h is going to be very small, so what you add here is going to be a very tiny amount of convexity, but still there's an extra parameter here which governs how much convexity you are adding, even though you are multiplying by epsilon, multiplying by h. Okay, so what if you do this? So if now you consider P, the operator P phi epsilon, the conjugated Laplacian, when you have the weight replaced by the slightly convexified one. So if this one would be E phi epsilon over H minus H squared Laplacian E to the minus phi epsilon over H. And you do the same thing as we did before, so we split into self-adjoint and skew-adjoint parts. So then, so when you now do the computation for the principal symbols, the commutator of the principal symbol of the commutator of capital A epsilon and capital B epsilon, so it turns out that you will have a little bit of positivity. So what you're going to get is some constant, and there's going to be a multiple of H, and then still you have your parameter epsilon there. Okay, so, sorry? Yeah, so it's a simple computation, so you have your A epsilon, B epsilon, which are obtained from A and B by replacing phi by phi epsilon. And then you just compute the Poisson bracket. It's just an algebraic computation. And somehow you need to identify some parts in the commutator which are multiples of A epsilon and multiples of B epsilon. And then when both of these are zero, then you are still left with something which is positive. And actually, so Colin was asking about this condition that the gradient of phi should be non-vanishing. Actually, the one place where it's used is here. So this C naught is some constant which basically only depends on the original phi, and it's only going to be positive if the gradient is non-vanishing. Okay. So what this is saying that when H is small, then you have a tiny bit of positivity in the principal symbol of the commutator. But now you can use this Gordan inequality argument again to get an estimate of this type, but with the slightly weaker powers of H. Okay, so you will have C depends on epsilon. The idea in this argument is somehow you need to choose, so epsilon is always independent of H, but you need to choose it small enough so that the constants which you get from here will be enough to deal with all of the kind of extra terms which come up when you quantify this symbol. And so you need to be able to absorb a lot of terms by using this positivity, so you choose epsilon small enough independent of H so that you can do that. Okay, so what we've done is we've obtained a Karlmann estimate for not the original operator P phi, but for P phi epsilon. But now the idea is that so the amount of convexity which we added was so little that you can go back from phi epsilon to the original function phi. And it's actually easy to see. So here, your P phi epsilon, so since phi epsilon is phi plus something, so then e to the phi epsilon over h is e to the phi over h times e to the this thing divided by h. So you actually just get e to the phi squared over 2 epsilon. And then you have P phi e to the minus phi squared over 2 epsilon. And somehow the point is that so you have in this argument you have fixed epsilon so small that you can absorb all of the error terms and get this estimate. And now that you have fixed epsilon so that you have this, so then you can just use the fact that where if you just look at this exponential e to the phi squared over 2 epsilon. So the exponent is always non-negative, so this is bounded by 1, and this is bounded by another constant depending on epsilon. So somehow after you have fixed epsilon so small that you get this, so then you can just estimate the way these exponentials in a simple way. So you will get an estimate for the original. So M is always compact with boundary, and U is a compact supported test function. Yeah. Yeah, as I said, this is not the only possible way you can convexify your weight. You could try to add some other convex stuff. And as you say, in two dimension, things are again more flexible, so you can use other convexifications to, for instance, deal with the case of proving Karlemann estimates of manifolds which are not compact, so you have something going on at infinity. And in three and higher dimensions, I'm actually not sure what kind of other convexifications would be useful here. But I'm pretty sure this is not the only one. There should also be others. Okay.
Do you need some estimates for each one?
Yeah, we do. But you do get that, so actually you will have that, I guess, the gradient. So I guess this should be the following kind of estimate. Well, you actually get it from the same proof, but I'm, for simplicity, I'm just not talking about it.
And then you estimate this, it's enough to estimate the derivatives of the Euler, for further derivatives of the Euler.
Sorry?
When you go to 50 by epsilon, that is also the special derivative of U, and that's not too short, they are small, they are subordinate.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, so this is kind of a sketch of how you can get the Karlemann estimate out of this abstract condition. But of course, I didn't do the details. But so what I want to do today is actually give you another proof of this Karlemann estimate, which is somehow, it's more elementary. It doesn't use any symbol calculus, and it has also some other benefits. So that's actually what I'm going to do next. Yeah. Right.
You know, it has h squared factor, and gradient u is of order o over h squared, and that's just small. Would the term be large?
Yeah, so it's true. There's an h squared here, so yes. They somehow go away. Yeah.
There is one from
okay, I'm following. Okay. So.
Well, I'm looking just at this.
Right.
And if you look what is there, there appears like a mixed derivative. You differentiate one e to the power and one u.
Right.
And u has the norm 1 over h squared.
Right.
And phi is the norm 1 over epsilon. So all together it's 1 over epsilon.
Yeah.
So 1 epsilon is large.
Yeah. Okay, so that's actually a good point. So if you look more precisely what this constant, how it depends on epsilon, I think you get epsilon times C naught. So somehow, if you divide by epsilon, then you will have H over epsilon here. So you will have a very large constant, 1 over epsilon times the L2 norm of U. Yeah, it could be a square root also here. Yeah, probably it is a square root because I'm using the norms and not the norm squared. So the idea is that when your constant is of this type, so then this term is nice, so you can absorb a lot of errors in this term because this constant 1 over square root of epsilon is large. So that allows you to take care of these mixed derivatives. Okay, so so let me just give you a different way of proving Karlsruhe estimates of this type. So that's kind of the traditional way of how you would prove them in Rn, or at least how people in inverse problems have done it. So you are in Rn, and you consider the limiting Karlsruhe weight, which is just a linear function, and you want to prove let's try a Karlsruhe estimate of this type. So L2 in Rn is bounded by, okay, and now, because I'm not going to use symbol calculus anymore, I'm going to switch from a small parameter h into a large parameter tau, because I'm not quantizing anything, so this is probably slightly clearer. And these would be norms in Rn. So this is kind of the Karlsruhe estimate in Rn that you might expect to prove. And actually, this is not what I'm going to prove. So this is going to be a weighted estimate. So there's going to be weight. So they are not L2. They are some weighted spaces. Okay. So basically, how would you do this? So it's actually enough to solve the equation e to the tau x1 minus Laplacian. Yeah, okay, so if you, okay, but I'm now working in Rn. So it's enough to solve equations of this type and then prove that the L2 norm of the solution is bounded by constant over tau. I guess like this, and really tau is going to be very large, going to infinity in the end. Sorry? Yeah, could be. Okay. So now you are in Rn, and so if you consider, for instance, if you differentiate once, or if you take the gradient and conjugate it by the exponential, so d is 1 over I times the gradient. So this is just, so you differentiate, and then you will get I tau, and the first coordinate vector. So this operator here, so minus Laplacian is basically the gradient squared. So this will be d plus I tau e1 squared, which will be minus Laplacian plus 2 tau d1 minus tau squared. Okay, so the operator here is a constant coefficient operator, so it's natural to try to solve this equation by taking Fourier transforms. So if we do this, so we have e to the tau x1, let's see, minus Laplacian plus 2 tau d1 minus tau squared u equals f. It's basically, if you just take Fourier transform formally, 2 I tau xi 1 minus tau squared of u hat is equal to phi f hat. And then, so there's going to be a symbol here, which I denote by p of xi. So it's formally equivalent with u being the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over p of xi f hat. Okay. So So this is kind of the formal solution of your problem, and then the norm estimates are obtained by somehow looking at this symbol. But now here the problem is that this thing P which you are dividing by has zeros. So here. So it has zeros exactly on the set of psi in Rn for which psi has length tau, and I guess psi 1 is equal to zero. So it's a codimension to submanifold of Rn, which is a zero set of the symbol. So somehow you need to be careful when you divide by this. But still you can do it, so. And this was done in this basic paper of Sylvester Ullmann. So you can divide by P. And actually you will get a good solution U, but it will lie in a weighted L2 space, so it will lie in polynomially weighted L2, so I'll define it in just a moment. Where delta is any number between minus 1 and 0, and this L2 delta of Rn is all f in L2 locally, for which somehow, okay, I'll define this. So this bracket x to the delta f is in L2 of Rn, and then the bracket is just 1 plus x squared to the 1 half. Okay. So this is how you would prove these Karlmann estimates in Rn, just for your analysis. And then the question is, could you try to do a similar thing on a Riemannian manifold? And the answer turns out to be, if you have a limiting Karlmann weight, then you can, at least under a... Okay, so I'll tell you exactly when you can. Okay, so let's try to do a similar thing on the manifold. So we are going to be in the setting where, okay, it stopped. Okay, so let phi be a limiting Karlmann weight in. Oh, okay. Let's try. Nice. Okay, so phi is limiting Karlmann weight in MG. So we saw yesterday that this implies that locally your G, so there will always exist a set of local coordinates that your metric is going to have the following form. There's a conformal factor and there's a Euclidean direction. So, and this I didn't say yesterday, but it's probably easy to believe that in these coordinates phi of x is always x1. So your manifold will always have this form locally. So now what I'm going to do, I'm going to assume this form globally, and then I'm going to prove the Karlmann estimates by Fourier analysis. Okay, so I'm going to assume that my compact manifold boundary is contained in a cylinder, where T is just a real line cross M naught, and G is, there's a conformal factor, and then there's the Euclidean metric in the first variable, and then there's the transversal metric G naught here. So the picture is like this. So you have a cylinder, here you have the direction x1, which is the Euclidean direction, and then you have some transversal manifold M0 G0, which I'm going to assume is a compact N minus 1 dimensional manifold with smooth boundary. Okay, so in this picture, the original compact manifold boundary M is, sorry? Yeah, you can also close it if you want, but I'm going to use the case when you have a boundary. And that makes it into a nice cylinder. So in this picture, your original MG is just sitting inside the cylinder here. So it turns out that basically eventually we want to solve inhomogeneous equations in M, but it will be enough to solve them in the whole cylinder. So you just have your functions f in M, then you extend them by zero into the cylinder, and then you solve the equation in the cylinder, and then you restrict the solution to your original manifold, and you are good. Okay, so that's the setting which I'm going to assume here. And okay, so this looks like there might be a loss of generality here that I'm assuming. I'm assuming globally this form of the metric, which we know. Whenever you have limiting current weight, it only has it locally. But I'm actually not sure if there is a loss of generality here. So there's some. As I said, this is the fact that you have a limiting Karman weight, which by the theorem yesterday is the same as saying that in a conformal metric you have a unit parallel vector field. And then this parallel vector field means that basically the metric is locally in this way. You can also see it from this Deram local decomposition theorem, but there's also a global Deram decomposition theorem, which is saying that if you have a complete Riemannian manifold and then you have a unit parallel vector field, then it splits globally as a product, so it's actually globally a cylinder. So the only thing here is we have a boundary here, so the manifold is not complete. But then I think it might be still possible that you might be able to extend your, so basically, so the way you state this stuff is you have an open manifold, then you have a compact subregion, and then you have a unit parallel vector field in this open manifold, and there's a question whether you can extend your unit parallel vector field to be somehow into a global Riemannian manifold, or maybe you cannot. So if any of you has ideas, I would be happy to hear. Okay, anyway, so this is what I'm going to assume. And okay, so let me go ahead and define some function spaces on the cylinder. So define. So L2 in the cylinder is just L2 in the cylinder with respect to dvg. And I'm going to define also weighted L2 spaces in the similar way as I had in the Euclidean case. But now in this case, I'm only going to require a polynomial growth condition in the x1 in the Euclidean direction, which is the only direction which goes out to infinity. And then I need an h1 space. So this is all functions in L2 delta, so that also the first order derivatives are in L2 delta. And then I'm going to need one more space, which is the space of Sobolev functions which vanish on the boundary of the cylinder. And this is the notation for it. So this is all functions f in h1 delta of t, where f vanishes on the boundary of the cylinder. Right. Yeah, I'm going to comment on that. Okay. So then let's go for the main theorem. Okay, so let me check that I get it right. So delta is going to be bigger than 1/2. So people who know Agmon scattering theory will recognize this condition. And I'm going to assume that my conformal factor in front of the metric is going to be 1 for x1 large. And this assumption is not optimal, but it's sufficient. And I'm going to have a potential V in the cylinder, and I'm going to assume some decay with respect to the x1 direction. Okay, so then the result is that there are constant C naught, tau naught, such that whenever our large parameter tau is big enough and tau squared is outside of the spectrum of the Dirichlet Laplace-Beltrami operator on the transversal manifold, so then for any f in the space L2 delta of t, there exists a unique function u in h1 minus delta vanishing on the boundary of the cylinder of t, such that e to the tau x1 minus Laplace g plus v e to the minus tau x1 u equals f in t. Okay, and your solution will satisfy the right norm estimates, which is somehow the Karlmann estimate part of it. So the L2 minus delta normal t is bounded by constant divided by tau. FL2 delta of t, and then the h1 minus delta norm is bounded by constant times the L2 delta norm. Okay. So that's the main theorem. It gives you unique solutions of the conjugated Schrödinger equation in the cylinder with the right kind of norm estimates. And this is from a paper with Koenig and Ullmann, I think, 2011. Okay, so let me just, before going into the proof, let me give you a few comments on, or somehow try to compare this proof with just the microlocal analysis proof. So. Okay, so the first thing is that notice that there is a uniqueness notion for solutions in this equation. So it's this exclamation mark here. So this means that if you fix decay at infinity for your solutions, and if you require that they will be zero on the boundary of your cylinder, then they will be unique. So if you compare with the other proof, so there is also a uniqueness notion there, and that actually was analyzed by Nachman and Street in a recent paper. But somehow, I guess, So the uniqueness which you get from the Carleman estimate or this integration by parts idea is a little bit more abstract. So it's not exactly some decay conditions at infinity or something like that. So the uniqueness notion, so the reason why I'm stating this is, of course, you might expect it to be useful in a number of situations. So one place where it's useful is if you want to do these uniqueness results in a constructive way. So there's a reconstruction algorithm also due to Adrian for the Euclidean Calderon problem in dimension 3 and higher. And it's somehow heavily based on the fact that you have unique complex geometrical optic solutions. And so the other reason why it might be useful is, if you recall what I said, that I somehow think of the Calderon problem as a model problem for many other questions which arise in elliptic PDE. So actually what we did in this paper with Kenning and Ullmann is we were studying the Maxwell equations and the corresponding inverse form for Maxwell equations at the kind of at the fixed frequency. And so it turns out that you can reduce the inverse problem for Maxwell equation, which is a first order system, into inverse problem for a kind of a Schrödinger system. So it's a big matrix Schrödinger equation. And when you do this reduction, the only way you can make sure that you don't lose information is that some of the components in the reduction have to be zero, and the uniqueness notion for the solution is going to eventually give you that these components will be zero, so you can go back to the original Maxwell. Okay, so this also gives an explicit inverse for this operator. And that can be used, for instance, to derive LP Carleman estimates. So this would be, sorry? So if V is zero, then they are somehow explicit. You can write down the inverse in the Fourier, in some kind of Fourier sense. And then if you have a V, so then you obtain an inverse for this by Neumann series from the free case. So the LP Carleman estimate means that you will have some LP norms here. And these are useful, for instance, when you are dealing with the equations with the very non-smooth coefficients. So with David Dos Santos and Carlos Koenig, we used this idea to actually derive the what corresponds to the scale invariant LP Carleman estimates for this operator, and we could do this to actually recover a non-smooth potential V in L n over 2, which is kind of an optimal result, also extending an earlier result in Euclidean case by Adrian and Lavin. Okay, so let me finally remark that somehow, when you look at the when you see the proof, it becomes evident that in the proof you could replace the operator which you have in a transverse direction, so this M naught G naught. So you could replace. It doesn't have to be the Laplacian. It could be something more general. So any basically positive operator with a complete set of eigenfunctions will do. And actually in the Maxwell case we made use of this flexibility. We actually had to replace this Laplace-Beltrami operator by the Hodge-Laplacian on differential forms, but somehow the proof goes through in a very similar way. Okay, so yep. Yeah, you could also do that. Yeah, so as I said, I mean, this is not the only way. So basically what you are interested in, your original manifold lies inside something which looks like a cylinder, and there's many ways how you can extend your larger manifold to be nice. So you could, as Lava said, you could, instead of a manifold, transversal manifold with boundary, you might have a closed manifold, and you might also have somehow bend this line around and have a circle. And I guess it might be just a matter of preference. I don't know what the uniqueness condition for the circle would be, though. Yeah, exactly.
What would be equal x1?
X1, but then you would need for carry control, which would be...
This is not correct.
Yeah, so anyway, so I'm going to give you the proof, and I somehow, of course, it's always a matter of opinion, but I mean, somehow it turns out this proof is easier than the original Sylvester-Ullman proof, because somehow when you are working in a cylinder instead of Rn, you can get you can avoid this problem of dividing by zero in a much easier way. So they have to do some careful analysis here, and in this situation we don't really have to do anything very careful. It's going to be rather simple. So let's start by assuming that the conformal factor is identically equal to 1. This is no loss of generality, because if it's not equal to 1, then if you recall the transformation law for the Laplace-Beltrami operator on a conformal scaling, it will just change the potential. So you can get rid of the conformal factor just by having a new potential. Okay? And okay, so then G is really a product globally and also the Laplace-Beltrami operator splits. So this will be just D1 squared plus the transversal Laplacian. So this you get just by looking at the coordinate expression and noting that now the determinant of the metric, when the metric of this form is independent of x1, so this comes out nicely. Okay, so now let's compute what the conjugated operator is. So So this is a kind of elementary fact, and then you can compute e to the tau x1 minus Laplace g e to the minus tau x1. So this is just e to the tau x1 d1 squared e to the minus tau x1. And then the transversal Laplacian will not affect this exponential, so it just comes out. So you compute this and it will give you minus d1 squared plus 2 tau d1 minus tau squared minus Laplace g0. Okay. So now I'm going to the Fourier analysis. So in the cylinder, when you have a Euclidean direction x1, so of course, because this variable is Euclidean, you can use the usual Fourier transform. But now you have a transversal manifold, which is a compact manifold with boundary, and as I said in the second, or I guess in the first day, kind of a, you can use as a substitute for Fourier analysis in M0, just use eigenfunction expansions. So I'm going to let lambda 1 be the Dirichlet eigenvalues of the transversal Laplacian. And I'm going to use a corresponding orthonormal basis of eigenfunctions. Of L2 of M0 consisting of eigenfunctions so this means that minus Laplace G0 phi L equals lambda L phi L in M0 and then phi L vanishes on the boundary of M0. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to define also the partial Fourier coefficients of functions on the cylinder. So if f is a function on the cylinder, so then the partial Fourier coefficient of so let's say f is in some of the weighted L2 spaces for some delta. So this is going to be the Fourier coefficient of F with respect to phi L okay, and then I can also take the Fourier transform in X1 which will be e to the minus I x1 xi1 f tilde of x1 l dx1. So this is really the Fourier, all of the Fourier analysis on the cylinder which I'm going to need. And then you have all kinds of Parseval identities for this, for instance okay, so let me just state that the L2 delta norm of F is going to be so the L2 norm on the cylinder is first you integrate over X1, then you integrate over the transversal part, and then you have this power of X1 and this is you can use, as I said, you can use all kinds of Parseval inequalities. For instance, this is equal to if you use the Parseval identity in the X prime, so this will be just some L going from 1 to infinity integral minus infinity to infinity X1 to the 2 delta and then you have F tilde of x1 L squared dx1, and this is also equal to sum L going from 1 to infinity and here you just have a weighted L2 norm in R like this. So these will be useful. Okay. Okay, so let's first do the uniqueness part of the main theorem. So let U be in H1 delta of the cylinder, assume it vanishes on the boundary of the cylinder, and this is true for some real delta, and assume that tau squared does not hit the spectrum of the transversal Laplace-Beltrami operator, and you assume that I computed the conjugated Laplacian, so it's just this thing here, and assume that U satisfies the following equation. So the uniqueness. Sorry. Okay. So let me first assume for the moment that V is equal to zero. So then U is equal to zero. So you can add the potential in the very end of this argument. Okay. So and the proof is just essentially you take Fourier transform in this equation. So you first write kind of partial Fourier expansion of U so then so you just plug this in here and then you note that the only thing which depends on x prime is this eigenfunction here, a minus Laplace t naught of the eigenfunctions is lambda l times the eigenfunction. So you get that minus d1 squared plus 2 tau d1 minus tau squared plus lambda l of u tilde of. So this is zero in the real line for all l. Okay. And I guess I'm omitting some details here. I'm actually using, even in this part, integrating Fourier transform, I'm using the fact that U vanishes on the boundary of the cylinder. So basically you need to be, so if you just believe that. Okay, so now I see that the partial Fourier coefficient at L just satisfies the ordinary differential equation on the real line. And I want to show that the solution of this ordinary differential equation is zero. And the easiest way to do this is to take Fourier transform in x1. Okay, so if U is in a weighted H1 space, so then the partial Fourier coefficients, just by these identities, are going to be in a weighted L2 space on the line. So in particular, they are tempered distributions, so you can always take Fourier transforms. And then you note that, so now you have this kind of symbol, and you ask, when is this zero? So this is only zero when, so you look at first the imaginary part. So when Xi1 is equal to zero, but so that's when the imaginary part vanishes. But when Xi1 is equal to zero, so then this whole symbol will be just minus tau squared plus lambda L. And by my assumption of not hitting the spectrum, that's actually going to be non-zero. So the symbol is never zero. So it means that we can divide by the symbol, so U hat is zero for all L. Which will imply that U is equal to zero. Okay, so as I said, the division by zero, somehow the problem goes away when you do it in this way. Okay, so then let me show you the existence part, because still still you need to show that there exists a solution in the spaces which I gave. Somehow I also want to show where these argmon type weights come in this business. So existence of solutions again for potential being equal to zero. So let F be in the weighted space L2 delta of the cylinder. The delta is bigger than 1/2, and we want to solve this equation. Okay, so let's do the same thing, try to solve it by taking Fourier transforms. So first I'm taking the Fourier transform in the x prime variables, which just means that I'm substituting the partial Fourier expansions of these functions. So minus Laplacian becomes the eigenvalue. In the real line for all L. Okay, so we really, again, we need to solve ODEs for the partial Fourier coefficients. And ODEs usually are not too difficult to solve. So one way to do this is to note that you can factor this second order operator into two first order operators. So you just note that minus d1 squared plus 2 tau d1 minus tau squared is equal to minus d1 minus tau squared. So this equation becomes minus d1 minus tau minus square root of lambda l d1 minus tau plus square root of lambda l u tilde is equal to F tilde in R. Okay. So we are reduced to really solving two first order ODEs. So now this is becoming really, really very manageable. Okay, so to do this, I'm just going to give you a little lemma on solving first order ODEs. So let A be a real number, which is non-zero. So then the equation U. So this is the kind of ODE which we are looking at solving in the real line. Has a unique solution U, which is a tempered distribution for any tempered distribution F. And I'm writing SA to be the solution operator. So now we need some norm estimates for the solution operator. So we are going to have and the following things. The norm, the L2 delta norm, and these are now just the polynomial with L2 norms on the real line, is bounded by constant depending on only on delta divided by A L2 delta of R if, let's see, so this works for any delta and for A bigger than or equal to 1. Let me just check. Okay, so this is somehow, so A here will be either tau plus square root of lambda L or tau minus square root of lambda L. And this is the thing which might go very close to zero. So when A is close to zero, need another estimate, which is the Agmon estimate. So it goes like this. What am I doing here? So this works for delta bigger than 1/2, so you change the weight, but this works for any A not equal to zero. Let me still mention the L1 to L infinity estimate. And I guess the constant here should be 1. Okay. So it's a very simple ODE result. And so let me indicate a little bit how this comes up. And I think maybe the most interesting case here is how this Agmon type ways, this L2 delta and L2 minus delta for delta bigger than 1/2 come up. So if you haven't seen this, then it's a nice trick, which I'm going to show. Okay, so first, solvability in the sense of tempered distributions. The easiest way to check this is to take Fourier transforms. So you solve this on the Fourier side. So this means that I xi minus A of u hat equals f hat, which is the same as u is the inverse Fourier transform of Fourier multiplier M times F hat, where M is I xi minus A inverse. Okay, so this is a smooth function of xi, and also the derivatives are bounded. So just when you take derivatives, you will get something like k factorial, and then you will get norm of a to the k plus 1. So what this means that if a is non-zero, so then m has bounded derivatives of all orders. So multiplication by m is a bounded operator on Schwarz space. So really, if F is a tempered distribution, then you get the unique solution U, which again is a tempered distribution. Okay, so if U equals SAF is in S prime. Okay, so then for the mapping properties. So the weighted L2 norm of SAF is by definition is x1 to the power delta of SAF in L2. And now this is if you take Fourier transform, use the Plancherel theorem, this is equal to d1 to the power 2 delta SAF hat L2, which is just the h delta norm of SAF hat. And now, okay, SAF hat is equal to MF hat h delta. And now you know that this is always bounded by, let's say, if k is some integer bigger than delta, this is bounded by the wk infinity norm of m, and then the h delta norm of f hat. And now you have the estimates for the derivatives here. So then this is bounded by some constant depending on delta. And if a is bigger than 1, so then you still have this 1 over norm of a here, f l2 delta, if a is bigger than 1. So that's the first norm estimate. Now let's go to the next one. So really, I mean, this Agmon type estimate is a consequence of the stronger l1 to l infinity estimate. And to prove this, I'm actually going to, instead of working on the Fourier side, I'm going to work on the space side. So let f in L1 and work on the space side. So you want to solve u prime minus au equals f in the spatial side. So you use integrating factors. So this is the same as u e to the minus at derivative is equal to f e to the minus at. And okay, let's assume a is bigger than zero here, and the other case is analogous. So now you integrate from x to infinity. So this is the case when these exponents are going to be decaying. So you will have minus u of x e to the minus ax is equal to integral from x to infinity f of t e to the minus at dt, so which is going to tell you that u of x is equal to minus integral from x to infinity e to the minus a t minus x f of t dt. So that's the solution of your ODE in the space side. And now, since you're integrating from x to infinity, so then t is always bigger than x, so this is a decaying exponential. In particular, its absolute value is always less than 1. And this immediately gives you the L1 to L infinity estimate. So then this thing here. Okay. Where should I go? So now let F be in L2 delta R delta bigger than 1/2. So then I want to prove this. So SAF L2 minus delta norm is equal to integral from minus infinity to infinity. We have t to the minus 2 delta SAF squared dt to the 1/2. And then you take out the L infinity norm of this function here. So this is bounded by SAF L infinity. And now you have integral from minus infinity to infinity of t to the power minus 2 delta. Delta is bigger than 1/2, so then it's integrable, so it's just some finite constant, depending on delta. Here's your L1 to L infinity bound for SA. And now you write this as integral from minus infinity to infinity. You have f of t dt. And then you multiply and divide by the right power of, I guess I want to do it this way. You have minus delta here and delta here. And now you apply Cauchy-Schwarz. So you will have integral from minus infinity to infinity t to the minus 2 delta dt 1/2, and then you have the L2 delta norm of f, and there's some constant depending on delta, and I mean all of this is just another constant depending on delta. Square. Is c delta prime? Oh, okay, it's also the square. Okay, and we are done. So this is a really nice simple trick of how you convert L1 to L infinity estimate into weighted L2 estimate. And the reason why I want to have this instead of the stronger L1 to L infinity estimate is because this thing involves weighted L2 spaces, so I can use orthogonality. I can use Parseval identity and all that. So for this estimate, it would not be so easy to do. Okay, so we are basically done. Since now, returning to this part here, so now I have two first order ODEs here, and I just figure out the nice solution operator. So then this will imply that U tilde is going to be minus s, I guess you will have tau minus square root of lambda l, s tau plus square root of lambda l, f tilde, like this. And so this is going to give you the partial Fourier coefficients of the required solution. So this is going to be the solution. And then the norm estimates will follow from the norm estimates form for this SA operator. So for instance, I wanted the Agmon type estimates for U, so this would be minus delta here. So first you use the Agmon estimate here. So this tau minus square root of lambda l might be arbitrarily close to zero, but still you have a constant which is independent of how close it is to zero times the norm of s tau plus square root of lambda l f tilde. And here you have the dual weight. And now I can use, because tau plus square root of lambda is always bigger than 1, tau is always bigger than 1, so I can use the first estimate, which gives me the decay with respect to tau that I wanted. Okay, so this gives me the solutions obtained by just taking the Fourier series of these coefficients, and this estimate is going to give me the right norm estimate for the final solutions. And so this is going to prove this main theorem in the case when there's no potential, but if, so I'll just say that if you have a non-zero potential, so then, okay, so then maybe I'll use a little bit more space. So you want to solve minus tau squared minus Laplace g naught plus v u equals f And then you have a solution operator for the free equation when v is equal to zero, which takes f into g tau of f, where this g tau of f solves the free equation. And we just saw that this operator has some norm estimates, L2 delta into L2 minus delta is bounded by some constant over tau. So then when you want to solve this equation, you try u equals g tau of v for some function v, and then you plug it into the equation, and then you need to solve. So this thing applied to g tau gives you the identity, and then you have v g tau v equals f. And now the norm of g tau is going to be very small when tau is large, and I assume that v has some decay at infinity, so this, the norm of this operator is going to be bigger than 1/2 when tau is sufficiently large. So I can solve this equation by Neumann series, and then u is g tau v is going to be the solution of the original equation. Okay, so this ends today's lecture, and I think it's somehow it's a surprisingly elementary argument which gives you this result, and it's a bit surprising it had not been observed before. I mean, it certainly has been used in other situations, but not in complex geometrical optics. So okay, so tomorrow I'm going to finish things and actually prove the result for the inverse form. Thanks. Sum up over L, yeah, sure. No, because of orthogonality. This is the Parseval identity. No, I'm just saying that the L2 delta norm in T of U squared is going to be some L goes from 1 to infinity, and then you will have U tilde of L2 delta of R squared, and then you use this estimate, so it's bounded by constant over tau sum of the norms of F tilde. So this will be minus delta, this will be plus delta. And now, so this is the Parseval identity. So this is just constant over tau. And then the L2 delta norm of squared in the cylinder. So you don't need any decay. I mean, certainly in Karleman estimates, for instance, when proving the LP Karleman estimates, one of the basic LP Karleman estimates due to Jerison and Koenig, who prove it for the Euclidean Laplacian and with the scale invariant LP spaces, so they use a very similar kind of Fourier analysis argument. And I would imagine also in scattering theory, when you have cylindrical ends, this would be the natural thing to use. Okay. Yeah, thanks.
after you have to make an extra transaction, that this splitting happens globally?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry, it's a little confused about.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're wanting to look and stay, you know, if it's a big, horrible, wanting to stay on the whole globe would be. You have different parallel flows in different parts of the manifold, or is it kind of?
Yeah, so somehow the idea is to reseal it. So you assume that you have limited current weight in some open manifold. So then you know that, I mean, you still have any topology. And you know that near any point, this neighborhood where it has. And so you do have global limit, you know. And somehow the idea, if this would be a complete remanifold.